drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks. Hi Luli, it's great to see you. Do you realise we've been doing this podcast for almost a year now?
I know, it's flown by, hasn't it, Felicity? But without sounding, sort of unbearably pleased with ourselves.
Why not?
Then let's sound unbearably pleased with ourselves. The best bit's been all the wonderful questions and feedback we've had from our listeners and, of course, working with you, clearly. That's another best bit,
And I love working with you too, Luli.
Thank you.
And it's true about our listeners, and I bet you've got another question from the inbox. But before we get to that, we need to talk about your family's Christmas tree.
So which element, Felicity, the theme, the design, or the press release?
We need to talk about all of it. First off, I've seen a photo and it's amazing. You have a great career ahead in interior design, should you wish to pursue it.
Thank you very much, Felicity.
but also because you're the only person I know, and maybe the only person on the planet, who issues an official press release about a Christmas tree theme, complete with quotes from your family.
So a couple of clarifications here. First of all, the press release only goes out to the family, and I actually make up the quotes for all of them anyway. But we've had a themed Christmas tree now, drinks-themed Christmas tree, for around 7 years, actually.
Can I just point out as a journalist that making up quotes for people is really unethical? But we'll move on. So you've had the tree for 7 years now. What got you started?
Okay, well, we've always had themed Christmas trees, but our first foray into drinks was actually champagne fizz. So we had corks and gold and dusky pink and champagne glasses, and naturally served champagne at our Christmas party. And it kind of just stuck. So the next year, people actually asked what the theme was going to be.
And so a tradition was born. Mm. Right. Do you deliver the press releases by hand? Do you slip them under doors or do you just email them?
Felicity, the Halstead family is a modern outfit with international members, so we do use email. Thank you.
Okay, so do you want to tell people about why this year's tree has different colours cascading downwards?
Okay, so Felicity, that's officially known in interior design circles as ombre, just so that you know, the cascading of colours. So this year's theme is tequila sunrise.
Oh, goodness, that's a drink I remember very well from my underage drinking days.
Okay.
Back then, it was the height of sophistication, but I haven't seen it for years and years. What made you decide to do that one?
Well, it was inspired by our family road trip through Arizona in September this year, which rounded off with us seeing the Eagles perform at the Sphere in Las Vegas. Yeah, pretty cool. So hence the reference to tequila sunrise.
Yeah, from memory, I think you've also done espresso martini. Mm-hmm. You did something with Bombay Sapphire. Yep. And last year's whiskey twist on a Singapore sling, I remember.
Correct, yes. So each year we pick a drink, design the tree around it, and then we host a launch party to match. You've got to have a launch party. So the guests drink the cocktail or drink of the year. And of course, this year it was tequila. So everyone got miniatures of tequilas to make their sunrises with. And then when they finish it, they hang the little bottles on the tree to complete the look.
And did everybody enjoy their tequila sunrise?
Can I just put it out there, having imbibed a few at the party, not as big a fan as I thought I would be.
Yeah, but it is a drink for very young people, I think.
Yeah,
as a tradition goes, I think it's inspired.
Thank you.
So since your Christmas tree is now literally themed around a cocktail, mm-hmm. this is the perfect entry point for today's episode. Here's the question. In drinks, does the truth matter or do good stories always win? Because the tequila sunrise itself has contradictory backstories.
Yeah, so I guess the big question is, does it matter which is the authentic story? So building on that, you know, it's still a stunning looking drink, as I said, although I'm not necessarily number one fan. Although, can I just add, if you add a dash of Campari, improves it, both colour and taste, quite a lot. Big tip.
Okay. All right. So the drink is cool. especially with Campari.
Yes.
And let's go back. This points to a fundamental disagreement about what makes a drink authentic. There are many people who would say it's a drink's facts and origins which matter most, which is probably the angle taken by most people in wine and craft beer and craft spirits. And then there are others, and maybe that's you, I'm not sure, who say what's important is whatever story the market believes. And this is a core disagreement.
Okay, which rather conveniently also brings us to a listener question, which came in from Adele in Australia.
And we hugely appreciate the question, Adele.
We do. So she says, younger drinkers say they want authenticity, but it's big, well-distributed brands that keep growing over these smaller, more authentic brands. So she says, does authenticity in drinks really matter?
Well, it does matter in terms of, is this something that younger drinkers say, or is it something that they care about when they actually buy? Yeah. Okay, so to even begin to answer this question, we need to define what authentic actually means.
Okay, so can I have a delve into definitions then, please?
Of course you can, Lily. I feel like we're going to maybe have some different opinions about the definition.
Okay. So from a definition point of view, authenticity is the perception that something is true to its claimed origin, character, or identity. That's a bit of a mouthful. So basically what it means is there isn't one fixed truth. It's the judgment or perception that people make about whether a product, a brand, or a story aligns. And that's what authenticity is.
Oh, gosh, that's very postmodern. That word perception is doing a lot of work there. So I think that when wine and craft drink makers use the term authenticity, what they typically mean is this thing actually comes from where it claims to come from and is made the way it says it's made. These are not the same thing. And I think getting the two definitions confused is where many of the arguments come from.
Yeah. I agreed. And not that I'm fixated with my Christmas tree, which, by the way, I am, and I'm quite proud
of. Well, it is an awesome Christmas tree.
Thank you. So the Tequila Sunrise is a great way, as you said, of having this discussion, because as you mentioned, there are two competing claims as to the authentic origin of the Tequila Sunrise.
Yes, I know this one. So most people think the Tequila Sunrise was born in the 1970s and sort of sanctified by the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, that's the famous version and the one that our Christmas tree was based on.
But the real origin comes earlier. Arizona Biltmore in the 1930s by bartender Gene Sulett. Tequila, creme de cassis, lime and soda. And it's in the hotel records.
Yeah, so creme de cassis. So that's really different from what we were drinking then. It's a very different drink.
Absolutely. And so in 1972, two bartenders in Sausalito reinvented it and made it tequila, orange juice and grenadine. So simpler, brighter and very photogenic. And then came the magic moment. Mick Jagger's tour manager tried it, the Rolling Stones adopted it, and suddenly that was the version that went global and the Arizona one disappeared.
Yeah, and that's partly, I guess, because the 70s version had a much better mental and physical availability. So very kind of classic Ehrenberg Bass.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's got a much better story. So Rock Band, Sunset Colors, Great in Photos will always beat Hotel Bar in the 1930s.
Yeah, and that story became kind of the shortcut.
Which is why the Sausalito version is now the official IBA recipe, so the myth one.
Yeah, which circles back to the question of authenticity. So is authenticity real, or is it the perceptions that we were talking about that make something authentic? So I'm going to fess up here. I'm kind of quite strongly on team perception here.
Right. That's a strong opinion, Lily, that to be authentic, the story doesn't need to be true. We just need to believe that it's true.
Yeah, so can I just do a really quick aside, Felicity? So you're just talking about me and my opinions there. So I was at a work dinner last week for one of the boards I sit on, and the people that I was sitting with came up with a new tagline for me: never knowingly under-opinionated.
Oh, that's great. And of course, that is a compliment, Lulu. That's a compliment. Yeah.
I hope so, but in the cold light of day and reflecting on it, I'm not sure it entirely was. Anyway, so let's tackle Adele's question. What is authenticity in drinks and does it really matter? So Felicity, your thoughts.
Okay, so I think there's probably two answers to that. The first is what people say they want and what they actually buy. These are two different things. So in that sense, authenticity might not matter when it comes to people parting with their cash. But when it comes to the origins and style of the drink, I think authenticity really does matter, because there are, you know, legal legal rules around origin and so on that are really were conceived as a way of maintaining trust.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is the alternative view. And if I was wanting to be contrarian or opinionated, as per my new tagline, it could be that, you know, we should give consumers stories that make sense to them, i.e. that they value, and that's then what becomes authentic.
All right, so let's draw the line here, because I think this is where you and I probably fundamentally disagree.
Okay, ask Felicity, never disagree. So go on, I'm all ears. Karen.
Okay, so if we just go back to the earlier definition, yeah. I'm going to say that authenticity means factual accuracy, traceable origin, and historical integrity.
Okay, that's quite a list. So to challenge that, does it matter that the Tequila Sunrise story isn't the original one, for example?
It would if a brand tried to market itself by calling itself the original Tequila Sunrise. Okay, but I do think the truth matters regardless of the sales pitch.
Okay, so this Sausalito version, the one that we all now know, and the official version, as you just said, is the drink that the world orders. I guess that's the version that then becomes authentic in the market.
Yeah, but are we talking about two different things? So if Possibly. By the word authentic, you mean this became the correct way to make a tequila sunrise, for sure. It's the standard. There's no problem with that. But if you mean someone making claims that are false, that's a different thing and it's important.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So we expect accuracy, yes. But if somebody at a bar wants the real Tequila Sunrise, they mean the Rolling Stones version, then it means that's the drink that has become authentic.
Okay, so this is getting very meta. Okay, so story about cocktails is neither here nor there.
Yeah, yeah.
But when there are claims made that aren't true, people get really burned. Like if they end up paying a premium for heritage that doesn't exist or for methods that cut quality.
Okay, so I do have to agree with you there. Okay, yeah, I will admit agreement, yeah.
So authenticity in some ways is about trust. And if the trust goes, the whole category is going to pay for it. So think about something like the explosion of whiskey fraud we've seen in the last decade. This stops people buying because they no longer trust what's in front of them.
Yeah, so okay, this is where marketing theory perhaps or marketing insight research can help us. So Michael Bevelin studied luxury wines and found that they were built on authenticity in two ways. So basically the two views we've been talking about. So first, what he calls indexical, like index authenticity. So what you've been advocating for, the verifiable facts of it.
I'm going to start using that, indexical authenticity.
I know, it's a good word. It's
good
combo, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I would call that material reality. So things that are either true or they aren't.
Yeah, exactly. And then he points to the other type of authenticity that we see in luxury wine, which he calls, so you can borrow this one as well, iconic authenticity. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like the cultural performance being real. So the perception stuff, basically.
All right. So I'm going to agree. I think that's really, really important. But authenticity is also about constraint. Mm. So for example, Burgundy is Burgundy because you can't grow Cabernet there. Mezcal is Mezcal because it must come from agave in Mexico.
Yeah, absolutely. But those constraints are what someone wrote into law because they wanted to protect the product. So basically, the regulations follow whoever had the power to write that law. So they often feel kind of sacred, don't they, or untouchable because everyone kind of becomes to believe in those laws.
Well, cynical me would say they feel sacred because if you ignore them, somebody will sue you. If you put champagne on a Prosecco label in the EU, that's not a creative interpretation of authenticity, but a decision that's going to land you in court.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not saying you can print whatever you like and you know, kind of make stories up. But somebody made those boundaries or defined those boundaries in the first place. They didn't just happen.
All right, we really are going deep into postmodernism. We could have Michael Foucault here. So stop us going around in circles. Why don't we talk about why people care about authenticity in the first place?
Okay, good point. So basically, it's mental shortcut. And what authenticity does is helps us as consumers to kind of feel safe. This is trustworthy. You can basically stop thinking now. So Dan Ehrlich, so one of my heroes in the world of behavioral economics, calls it the need for coherent stories. So basically what we're trying to do is make sense of the world around us, and these sort of authentic stories help us do that.
So in this sense, when you're talking about wine or whatever, authenticity is a proxy for quality. So if a label says Loro Piana on it, you can be certain the garment is using the highest quality wool in the world. You don't have to be a judge of cashmere yourself.
Okay, so clearly I move in the wrong circles, Felicity. What did you say? Loro Piana?
It's okay. An Italian luxury brand whose use of high-end wools like cashmere and merino and vicuna has become a byword for the very best in fibre.
Okay, so every day is a school day, Felicity. I've learned something new. Thank you. And also unveiled my ignorance on cashmere. But back to authenticity. So consumers treat authenticity, as we were just saying, as a sort of shortcut for quality, but they don't want this kind of forensic analysis going
on. Yeah, no, that's true. And by the way, if you can't afford really good cashmere, you should buy Shetland wool.
Okay. Yes, thanks for the tip.
I agree with the point you're making.
Okay. But I also think that part of the confusion around authenticity is that we talk about it like it's sort of one thing and it's basically the sort of longevity of the history stuff we've been talking about, but it isn't. So drinks don't have a single source of authenticity. They've got multiple. So guess what, Felicity? I've got a framework for us.
Luli, I think we need a framework at this point. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. So we think about types of authenticity in drinks. We can in the following way. So we've got first is heritage authenticity. So that's what we've been talking about, you know, and if you violate the heritage, and then that becomes a problem. But there's also, secondly, origin authenticity. And thirdly, personality or founder authenticity. Okay. And so what each one does is it answers the kind of question of what makes this real in a different way, if that
Do
makes
you think
sense.
This podcast has indexical authenticity or founder authenticity?
I hadn't been thinking about that, Felicity. I don't know.
Time to think about it. Okay, so do you want to break down what these different types of authenticity actually are?
Okay, good plan. Now, seeing as you've been so strongly arguing for history as the basis of authenticity, Felicity, why don't you kick us off with that?
Well, to be fair, I'm not claiming history so much as I'm talking about material reality. So does the thing come from this place and was it made according to the legal specifications of this place?
Yeah, and that's an argument from history because it's an authenticity that trades on time and continuity.
Sure, but it's also tethered to the material world. You can't magic it into being by spinning a good story.
Yeah, so yeah, that's true. And sometimes that's genuinely earned. So, okay, let's take Chartreuse as an example. You know, real monks, real recipes from the 1600s and still made by them.
That is my favourite example.
I bet. Did you do a story about it?
I did many years ago.
Come on.
So Chartreuse is supposedly based on a mysterious manuscript. And even today, there are only two monks from the order that makes it that are allowed to know what's in the recipe, which has caused problems when they've wanted to export it, like in the US, and the US demanded an ingredients list.
Yes, I can see the problem in the modern day era that they weren't facing in the 1600s when they first came up with it. But okay, I've got another thought though. What would happen if something happened to both of those monks? So like they were in a car accident.
Do you know
together?
What? They have thought of that. The two
no.
monks are not allowed to travel together.
No way.
That's true.
Really? So that's definitely authentic then. But their heritage is also functioning here in terms of constraints and limits what they can actually do then.
That's actually true. So they're limited to how many bottles they can make. I think it's, don't quote me, I think it's like 1.6 million because they still make it by hand and they don't want it to turn into industrial production.
Okay, so moving us on then to the second type of authenticity in drinks, origin authenticity.
Okay, and I think this is the type of authenticity that matters most in wine and, dare I say, beer.
Yeah, absolutely. So origin authenticity is the belief that a drink is real because it comes from a specific place. So the geography, the soil, the terroir. It's the idea that where it's made determines the authenticity.
I'm agreeing with you, Luli.
Oh, that's nice. Okay, but there's a twist. So origin authenticity, I think, only works if consumers actually care about the place it comes from. So if the region means nothing to you, the terroir might as well just be like a nice backstory on the label because it doesn't matter to you. You don't value it.
Okay, I'm going back to disagreeing with you.
Good.
So you're talking about authenticity as a sales tool, but authenticity is a much bigger concept than that. So that there are many terroirs that have fallen out of fashion, but they still exist as discrete entities.
Okay, let me see if I can turn your opinion around. So let me share with us an example that blows the whole notion of authenticity of place wide open. And it's one of your favourite beverages, Felicity, Baileys.
Oh, I bloody love Baileys. What a genius drink that is. Yes, let's talk about Baileys. Marvellous product.
You and the famous, who you won't name, wine critic you saw downing a large measure in an airport lounge. You're still not going to name them.
No, not on air. I'll tell you privately.
Oh, okay. Okay. Genius is the word. So the whole concept, and we've discussed this on previous episodes, was invented in a London boardroom in 1973. So no monks, no rustic Irish farmhouses, just an innovation team trying to create a category.
Right. I'm following you so far.
Okay. So the origin is glorious. So led by, as we talked about before, David Gluckman, and he later admitted they created Baileys. And here's his direct quote. Irishness felt like a flavour. So they were basically inventing the taste of Ireland in a bottle in London.
Yeah, but the cream and the whiskey really do come from Ireland, and they have to by law. It's authentic to what it is. It's a modern Irish cream liqueur, so it's not pretending to be centuries old.
No, but my point's simple, that the story came first, so the liquid came second. Baileys didn't need heritage. We now treat it as kind of culturally Irish because that's what has happened to the brand because it's been managed so well and so coherently.
Or because it's actually an Irish cream whiskey by law, meaning that authenticity doesn't have to be anything other than true to itself.
So we're back to where we started. You think authenticity is factual, traceable and anchored in history. And I think authenticity is equally about what the market believes, the perceptions.
Okay, so here's what we do agree on. Baileys, sponsor us. I promise I will post pictures of myself drinking it on Instagram.
Genius.
Lily may do a tree.
Yes, I was just about to say, I could do a Baileys themed Christmas tree next year. That would be really exciting, wouldn't it?
Yeah. You'd have to have a little shamrocks because it's Irish, Lily.
I would. I had thistles on my whiskey tree. So, I would have shamrocks on my Baileys tree. But you can imagine how messy the Christmas drinks party, themed party would get if we were all drinking Baileys all evening.
Oh, my God. All right. So, but get back to the point.
Back on track.
I think that when people talk about authenticity, specifically in wine, they mean something other than just the branding. So the label and so on might be terrible, but it's the connection to the craft that excites people. So authenticity means it comes from a real place and was made by a real person.
Okay. So that brings us nicely, as if we planned it, to the third type of authenticity. So this is personality or founder authenticity.
Right. So now we're going to talk about George Clooney, aren't we, and his Casamigos tequila, blockbuster stuff.
Yep. Because it's successful, because it has mental availability. It's widely available, is a coherent brand. So it's easy to buy and remember.
Okay. So if we're going to talk about celebrity drinks, let's talk about Trump vodka. Remember that?
Oh, how could I forget, Felicity, one of your favourite stories. So we covered it in an earlier episode, didn't we? And if I remember correctly, it was a kind of flashy launch in around 2006, I believe, with a lot of luxury and celebrity all going on. And this was at the time when Trump was still, shall we say, universally popular?
Well, the reason I'm thinking about that, because there's a story that came out a few days ago saying that Trump may actually bring back the vodka. Now, at the time it was launched, and this when it was launched, he was actually pretty popular at that time. And so they launched it and then it kind of just faded away.
Yeah, just slowly and gently into the background.
Yeah.
Unlike him, yeah.
That's right.
But I guess the issue with Trump vodka is that the brand isn't coherent. So
yes,
you have a personality, I call him a personality, yes. But anyway, the point is that he's known to be a teetotaler, so it doesn't consume alcohol. So launching a vodka brand, obviously there's a disassociation or disconnect between the founder personality and the product category, in this case, vodka.
Okay, so do I get from this that you're saying founder authenticity is just very good at manufacturing the illusion of selfhood? That sounds very, that's a very complicated sentence, but
yeah.
Explain it to me.
Yeah, so I'm kind of saying that everything is a bit of a construction effectively. So the difference here is that personality authenticity is transparent. So it's not pretending to be ancient. It's not pretending to have, sort of centered in or in origin. It's not borrowing from any of that. It's basically saying, this is me, this is my personality, sort of take it or leave it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So this whole discussion reminds me of a roundtable I did in California a couple of years ago. And it was on this question of identity and authenticity.
Okay.
And one of the topics that came up was, can you just announce that you have an identity or do other people have to agree with you?
Okay, what was the consensus of the people at the roundtable?
Well, it was really interesting because the Americans on the table unanimously believed that you could just announce that you were something or other and that's what you were. But we had Chinese and Europeans on the table and they all agreed that identity was something that was conferred upon you.
In what sense?
OK, Okay, so a lot of wineries want to be fine wine, right? It's something that they strive for. They do everything they can to get respect and scores and get listed in the right places. And what they ultimately want is they want to end up on the secondary market, right? But whether you end up in that collectible category is not something that you can engineer. It's something that other people like collectors and specialists have to agree on.
Yeah, it's the story and whether it means something to your end users, to your consumers, that determines whether you get that kind of recognition or not.
Yeah, but see, I sort of disagree with, like, I agree, but I also disagree because there are intrinsic qualities that people can recognise and you can't simply decide to have those qualities.
Okay, which takes us right back to Trump vodka, one of your favourite stories. So he effectively tried
I do read other things, I just want to make it clear. I don't spend all my time thinking about Trump.
And vodka. He tried to engineer a narrative that wasn't congruous, so kind of effectively nobody believed the story because of this disconnect.
Yes, and more importantly, they could probably see the real story. Rich guy trying to get richer by launching a cynical brand line.
Yeah, and from my side, it proves something slightly different, that you can't confuse founder conviction with consumer conviction. So when it works, that connection, it accelerates everything. But when it doesn't work, effectively you get a failed product or a failed brand.
Or you can start out well and then you can sell out. You can become inauthentic and everything will fall apart.
Ah, so you're thinking of something like Goose Island, for example. So the Chicago craft beer that went from local hero to effectively corporate sellout.
Ah, that's a good example. So Goose Island started out as a beer that had everything the craft crowd loves. Small, independent, comes from a very particular place, a very clear we are not big beer attitude.
Yeah, and then AB InBev bought it in 2011, completely rational business move from their point of view, sort of building up their beer portfolio, brand portfolio. But for authenticity, they're became then effectively an identity crisis.
Yeah, so the beer itself probably didn't change. I don't know, I'm not a drinker of it, but I'm assuming it didn't. But what changed was that perception of authenticity.
Exactly. So the whole premise had been we are the alternative to the corporations. And then once you join the corporation, effectively that authenticity story dies.
Yeah, not always. So we've talked about Guinness on the show and actually Guinness is owned by a big corporation and yet it's managed to retain that sense of Irishness and so on. But yes, for Goose Island, it stopped being a badge of rebellion and it became shorthand for selling out.
Okay, yes, it did. So Felicity, we're going to round out what authenticity is and discovering it's a multi-layered concept, as we've been talking about.
It is indeed.
It is. So it would be remiss of us if we didn't go back to Adele's question, because we've been having a lot of conversations about this. So can we go back to Adele?
Yeah, thank goodness you're keeping us on track. Well done.
Okay, I am to please. So reminder, it seems like a long time ago we were talking about Adele's question. Can you remind us what she was asking?
Okay, so she asks a really good question. She said, younger drinkers say they want authenticity, but it's big, well-distributed brands that keep growing over smaller, more authentic brands. So does authenticity in drinks really matter?
Okay, so there've been more articles and studies published this year, I reckon, stating that Gen Z value authenticity in everything, including drinks, and probably more studies than we, quite frankly, the world needs. Because they're all pointing in the same direction. So we're getting headlines like, and I'll quote one headline, Gen Z values authenticity and transparency, favouring brands that offer genuine storytelling and user-generated content over traditional advertising.
Yeah,
so those are the
response,
kind of headlines.
You know how much this just annoys me, the idea that only young people value authenticity and transparency and the rest of us love being told stories to and ripped off. But I guess the question is, what do they mean by that?
Okay, so if you dig into the studies, which I have done, overall the findings indicate that authenticity to Gen Z consumers basically means three things. It means sincerity. So we could think about that also, and sometimes it's cited as honesty. The second is consistency. I get the same thing each time. And the third element of authenticity for Gen Z consumers is transparency or realness.
That sounds quite a lot like the idea that something comes from a particular place and is made by a particular person.
Well, yes and no. So we could deduce, for example, that sincerity, so the first of the three on the list, is a mix of heritage and origin authenticity.
But of course, this comes down to the economic question. We know that what people say they value and what they spend their own money on are two very different things. So what does the data say? What do they choose in reality?
Yeah. So the data from Nielsen IQ, for example, has found that Gen Z consumers, according to their research, do value authenticity in the form of transparency, diversity, and social responsibility. And, okay, to your point that you've been making, they particularly value that over traditional heritage-based brand values, Felicity.
Well, see, I don't think that means you can completely wave away heritage. They might think the established brands are dishonest or boring, but they still want something that comes from the place it says it does.
Yes. So from what I can see from the research on this, Gen Z consumers do value authenticity in drinks. But I think what they're really saying is honesty. So kind of no made-up bullshit. And they also want consistency. I.e. I get the same thing every time. So if we really dig into and try and understand the research, it's these two things, honesty and consistency.
Well, I think you could sum that up in the word ethics, actually. Mm. But just let me jump in. So, okay, so the research says they value that, but does that translate into how they spend?
Not necessarily. No. Yeah. So as you pointed out, and that is true, for example, when we're doing research with consumers about sustainability. When there's a lot of claim of, yes, I want organic, yes, I want sustainably produced. But then when we, you know, walk into our store or our supermarket, wherever we're buying wine, in this case, the difference then becomes, am I willing to pay the extra $3? Often the answer is no.
Right. Okay. So, and my point still stands, I think, that, you know, this idea that only this generation values this. I mean, you know, from my memory, speaking as a Gen X, all of my friends valued honesty and ethics when we were in our 20s. And then, of course, everyone got seduced by the rising value of their houses.
Oh, okay. That's very cynical, even for
it's
you,
true,
Felicity.
Though.
So Gen Z consumers say authenticity, but often they're buying convenience and to a price point, as I was just saying. So they say heritage, but they basically want coherence. So why don't you sum up for us, Felicity, editor's head on, sum up what we've said.
All right. So we've talked about three different kinds of authenticity: origin, heritage, and personality authenticity.
Yeah. And I believe the success with authenticity depends on what your audience values. So you can have the best terroir story in the world, but if your customer doesn't care about Burgundy, they'll just buy the prettiest story.
Yeah, as I said before, I still think authenticity, as many people would understand it, is very separate from a marketing proposition. It's grounded in telling the truth about whatever it is.
Yeah, well, that's not too far from what Gen Zers mean when they say they value authenticity in drinks, because, as we were just saying, it's about being trustworthy and consistent primarily.
Okay, so what I'm taking away from this, and I'm just pulling this out the top of my head based on our previous discussions around branding, is that what actually counts in the marketplace is what you're constantly talking about, which is mental availability. And big brands have that because they're ubiquitous and presumably because they can price themselves effectively.
Yeah, and because they tell coherent and consistent stories about themselves. So about the product, and then the behaviours align, because it's all about mental and physical availability to drive purchase behaviour.
Well, clearly, as you've heard me discuss, Bailey's, clearly I am not immune to that. All right. So, and also, I guess if the story goes on long enough, somebody will eventually create a Christmas tree around it.
Absolutely.
Now, listeners, if you've decorated your Christmas tree around a drink's origin story like Luli has, we absolutely want photos.
We do. And maybe a Bailey's sponsorship while we're at it, please, for next year.
But, you know, we'll take a tequila sponsorship. We'll take all of them, authentically.
Yes, we will. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's a question of drinks, all one word, at gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.